I want to welcome everybody here to come to these Sunday afternoon talks for reflection, contemplation. To reiterate, the Buddhist approach is to stimulate and awaken the mind rather than to condition it. So this is, I think, one reason why, one of the main reasons why Buddhism is an attractive religion at this time in the Western world, because we no longer want to be told things. We want to be awakened. We begin to realize we have the ability to know in a way, in a more direct way than just through the grasping of somebody else's ideas or somebody else's views and words. So I get this note about Vinobananda Maitreya, who'd passed away on the 18th of July, 102 years old. And last time I saw him, I invited him to spend the Vasa Range retreat here, and he says, "Oh yes, I'll do that. I'll have to find time." I thought, 102, you know, it's. But he still had this. It's kind of a. His body was 102 only. Mentally, he was ageless. So. Subject for contemplation is Gate to the Deathless, which is, of course, my theme song, really. Because this has always been something that I felt very kind of intuitively, this sense of deathlessness. And of course, we live in a realm where death is the most obvious power that we all have to face, isn't it? After birth, and there's what happens between birth and death is all subject to various other conditions of happiness and suffering, success and failure, praise and blame. And so forth, but then the inevitable death is something that we all will experience in the future. And because the human tendency is to identify strongly with the physical body as being one's self, what we feel is really mine, then the sense of death is a very strong feeling. It's something that seems, this is definitely going to happen. We're all going to die, and death is something to dread, or it's oftentimes looked on as something bad or something depressing, because it is the unknown. It's what we haven't experienced yet, so it remains the mystery in terms of experience, in terms of physical death anyway. It's something we will find out, and we will all definitely experience. But between birth and death is the opportunity for enlightenment. So that on a Vesakha Puja celebration in the Theravada tradition, you have this, you celebrate the birth, enlightenment, and death of the Lord Buddha. And so Western people who like to be factual and historically accurate, they don't believe that the Buddha actually could have been born, he was enlightened and died, you know, on the full moon of May. It's just too neat. To like a package deal rather than an actual human life. But that's not the point, is it? It's the fact that now we're experiencing the enlightenment potential, say, between birth and death. Now this is a reflection, of course. And of course we tend to see enlightenment as something that is maybe very a remote possibility, isn't it? Something that is not, you know, that generally most people regard as being something very unlikely. So this is something to contemplate. What do we mean by enlightenment? And is it something that remote, that difficult, that impossible? Trouble with any religious tradition is it tends to put a religious the religious teachings into the kind of they're apotheosized, they're put up among the stars, they're raised up on high. So in Thailand, you even have monasteries that put all the religious books in a bookcase. They have a Buddha Rupa, and then they have a bookcase with the Tripitaka in it. And nobody reads this Tripitaka, but they bow to it. Very few would read it, but they bow to it. And they bow to the Buddha image, and they bow to the Bhikkhu Sangha, you know, the monk, and thinking this is paying respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So religion oftentimes is put into this very high position to where the average person can't relate to it as something that they can actually do, or something that is something for themselves. So that even though we were all born and we know we're all going to die, enlightenment can be seen as something that maybe the Buddha did. Somebody like the Buddha could get enlightened. Who's this sage? Whose apotheosis is means that he's way up in the stars now. He's a special being with a fantastic history and with special qualities that none of us could possibly claim. We're also informed about the age as the Kali Yuga. The age of destruction, it certainly seems like that in many cases. And then there's so many ways, so many depressing ways to look at a human life at this time that we sometimes forget or don't appreciate or have never really contemplated or considered the opportunity that we have now and as living, breathing human beings at this time. No matter what yuga it is, or no matter if it's the end of a millennium, end of a century, or as far as Buddhism goes, it's the middle of a century. This is 25, 40, 41. It's the middle. But if you get into Christian, then it's the end of a century. So who's right, who's wrong? Or is this relative, or is it absolute, or what? But it does, what we can do with it is to reflect upon it, how conventions, how words, how teachings, how traditions, symbols and forms and ideas, how they affect our mind. And so this deathlessness, this gate to the deathless, is a symbol that to me had a lot of I was particularly found interesting, because for many people Buddhism is just a kind of almost a therapeutic a form of therapy where you kind of deal with your stuff, as they say. In Amravati, one woman recently criticized us for saying, all you people talk about is dealing with your stuff. So. I know this is the common jargon of the age, but sometimes that's what it seems like. We, you know, what are you doing today? Well, I'm just dealing with my stuff today. And for many people, that's probably what that's all they're doing. But as far as a religious path, which takes you to the ultimate, to the perfection of humanity, of being human. And maybe that's too high. Maybe I'm just being too high-minded or, idealistic or unrealistic about life. But and of course, people do throw these kind of criticisms at me, because a lot of people don't like this emphasis on the deathless. They find it uncomfortable, or it sounds too abstract, too nothing that they can really see has any value, because you can't see the deathless. You can't prove it in the way that you can prove the existence of suffering. Or a conditioned experience we all can relate to very well. That is, any form of pain or suffering or disease, we all have a good idea of what that's about. Or happiness, success, being praised, being prosperous, development, progress. We can all relate to these kind of images. As being, I want to be successful and happy and healthy and that is our the desires of this realm that we live in, and then the fear of everything going wrong, of being a failure, of being unhappy, of being sick and having terrible health, of getting cancer, of losing your loved ones and your home and your job and so forth. All these are the great fears of human society and of human individuals. And of course, religion's function is this pointing at the deathless, and this to be a religion, it has to be a convention, a tradition whose pointing directly at the deathless, this is a Buddhist way of looking at it, or say God or eternal life or whatever, various salvation, liberation, freedom, vimutti, moksha, salvation. All these are words that convey that ultimate realization that's possible for the human individual. So this is to be contemplated. Some Buddhists say, well, we don't believe in God and in an eternal soul, and these kind of, because the Buddha deliberately refrained from using terms of that kind. The Buddha's teachings were based on the experience of suffering and the realization of non-suffering. So he brought the religious path into a kind of practical experience that everybody can understand, because everybody suffers. Everybody has experienced suffering. But deathless, or the ultimate release, or nibbana, or these kind of words, they stop the mind. We can't figure them out. We would like to. We'd like to say, what is there a deathless, or what is it then? When you die, that means if you're enlightened, your kind of soul kind of merges with the ultimate soul or something like this, or Buddha would never talk like that. Or there's an ordinary self, and then there's a over-self. Some people talk like this, but Buddhists, we don't talk about over-self and little self. We talk about self as no self. So that there's a sense of trying to describe the realization of the deathless. These are various attempts at doing that. Merging with God, or union with the ultimate, or ultimate liberation. But we don't know what they are. We can make them sound like, they sound very good, don't they? Like going to heaven, or union with God, or one with the ultimate, things like that. It sounds like it might be very, you know, desirable thing to aim for. But in terms of our own experience, we don't really know what it is. We maybe a heaven state where everything is easy and beautiful and pleasant, and we're always happy is maybe the best we can create a vision of the afterlife at its best. Is a kind of heavenly realm, like a children's view, isn't it? The soda water fountains, mountains of ice cream. You can stay up as late as you want. And everybody's nice and kind, and you're with God, and He's loving, and you don't hurt yourself, you don't get measles or chicken pox in heaven. Like that, it must be like a child's vision of, wouldn't it be nice if everything were nice, if everything were perfect. But in terms of experience, we don't know. The realm we live in is filled with a lot of pain and frustration. So I remember even as a small child, you know, you fall down and skin your knee, and then you'd feel this pain in the knee, and I'd wonder, why do we have to suffer pain? You know, if I were God, I would have created human beings so they wouldn't have any pain. It's a thing like that. Why do we have to have pain, like a skin knee, or spraining an ankle, or breaking an arm, or getting the flu, or the measles, or the chicken pox? Why do we have to suffer with this stuff? Why couldn't have God created a world where there's no pain and no disease? Because that's what, you know, would seem like would be a perfect realm. If you're going to create something, why not create something perfect? Why create something that's basically imperfect? Well, these are the moral dilemmas and the doubts that arise in religious-minded people. The Buddha never used a creation theory, and so he never, and when the pandits and the Brahmins and the sages and the religious leaders of his time, you know, used to try to corner him. And in the scriptures, some of these are quite amusing. They try to corner the Buddha and say, okay, is there a God or not a God? And what happens when you die? When the enlightened one dies, does he merge into something called the deathless, or what happens to the soul and so forth? And the Buddha remained silent. And then the pandits would say, he doesn't know, he can't answer the question. If he's a Buddha, he certainly must know everything, you know. And so he certainly would know this if he's a real Buddha. So he's obviously not a Buddha. But then silence itself is an answer to that question, isn't it? Because silence is where we stop. You know, and when you go silent, you stop trying, you stop thinking, you stop struggling. It's the stopping of that endless kind of movement of the mind, that restlessness of thinking and emotion that we get caught by, we get pulled into, we get carried away with it. And that's where we find in our own society now, here in England, isn't it? So much suffering is around the restless, wandering mind, the obsessive thoughts, the negativity we have, how much we worry about everything, how many things that we can find to worry about in a society that's fairly well run, that is affluent, and yet we can spend our days, you know, just worrying about next year, or what's going to happen when I do, when I retire, or things like this. What's going to happen when the children grow up? Or will I lose my job? This is a problem that many people worry about now: redundancy, unemployment. So the mind is very much a mind that creates problems. It's a creative mind. We create endlessly. We proliferate. We bring out into it, make things exist that are not often necessarily skillful or useful or good, but habitual. We're caught in the momentum of our habits and this habitual kind of anxiety and worry seem to follow us even into a fairly safe family life, society, economic and political conditions that are, you know, reasonably safe and stable compared to most countries, and yet we can what we produce out of our minds is oftentimes quite negative. We see what's wrong. We see how things can go wrong. How everything we've given importance to, every investment we've made in life can be just taken away from us or suddenly vanish into thin air. Ajahn Veerdhamma was telling me about coming back from Latvia recently, where he is saying these people in the Eastern European countries, like Latvia, they work hard under the Soviet system, save lots of money, saved as much money as they could in these banks, and then suddenly they lose it all. You know, imagine that. That's working 40 years and thinking, I'm going to retire now with a good pension. Suddenly your money's worthless. Just how it can just dissolve into thin air. 40 years of hard work and saving. And so we recognize that life on this planet in this way is basically like this. It's very uncertain. Its nature is insecure. And so the Buddha was pointing to this that the conditioned realm is something not to take refuge in, not to use your life only to seek security and happiness in the conditioned world, either through finding somebody, a person you love, and getting dependent on them, or having lots of money, or political and economic systems, social systems. All of these things are subject to sudden and immediate change. And so it's either through war, or through economic failure, or through catastrophe, or natural catastrophe. When there's a terrible tidal wave that hit Papua New Guinea, suddenly just, you know, overwhelmed, I think 1,000 people, they haven't been able to count all the dead bodies yet, of a tidal wave that just completely demolished the part of Papua New Guinea. This was only a couple of days ago. So this uncertainty, this insecurity, is is the suffering that we tend to resist. It's like, tell me everything's going to be okay. Say everything is all right. Tell me that you know, we go to the fortune tellers or the astrologists or anything, just to hope to get some good prophecy for the future of prosperity and success and happiness. And like on birthdays and things like this, you say, may you live a long life and be successful and prosperous and happy and healthy for more and more years. And this is, you don't say, may you awaken to the insecurity of this realm. That you could die almost any time and any savings you might have might suddenly disappear. This is not a way to be make yourself popular in life. I think that would be more honest, wouldn't it? But yet, in our hearts, we long for this, like a long life, which may be, in some cases, an aspiration for the ultimate, for the deathless. Because when you think about living a long life in a physical body, it isn't sound very attractive, especially when you're getting old, to think of having to live 64 more years in an increasing decrepit physical body. Doesn't sound like an attractive prospect to me. I think maybe, well, modern medicine will come out with increasing, you know, take a pill and suddenly your whole, you know, it'll renew everything in your body and you'll suddenly have a young heart, a young liver, a young kidney. Everything will go young again. I think, what if we reversed the whole process? You find yourself getting younger and younger and ended up as a baby. That would be it. I don't think I'd like that, would you? In terms of, say, like Christianity, like when I was Christian, we were told God is here with us all the time. And so then you kept thinking, well, where is he then? You know, I don't see him. And you just have to open yourself to God and he'll be there. And so I remember when I was young trying to do this, trying to open myself to God and waiting for something to happen, nothing happened. So, because I still saw God as a kind of, you know, something that was going to happen, as a condition, really, because the word God itself, that way of thinking, because Christianity so anthropomorphizes God that you always think of it as like this patriarchal figure. So in a part of you is kind of expecting some kind of patriarchal figure or something to happen that will say, I'm God and I'm with you all the time, and some statement, you know, or some voice out of inside or outside coming at you, you know, I am here, you are safe. And but nothing ever happened like that. So then one tended to dismiss that possibility as just Christian way of talking and kind of convincing you, trying to convince you to believe. In the Buddhist approach, oftentimes the deathless is something that's overlooked. Because it's not given a form like God the Father, or it's given some kind of presence as a in some kind of anthropomorphic form. So it remains like an abstraction, because deathlessness sounds like an idea, rather than a reality. Because everything we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think is transient and changing. It all ends. Everything ends. So there's this continuous beginning and ending going on as experience through the sense realm, through the conditions of the mind. And so we really think of when we try to contemplate the deathless, the mind goes quite empty. Try to think about the deathless. What kind of image? Can you get an image? Maybe a big kind of, like the Zen, or this kind of circle with one end open. About the neatest form, probably. That's just my impression. But then silence. Because when you stop thinking, everything goes silent. When the ending of thought, isn't it? When a thought ceases and you don't start thinking with some again, the silence, the mind is very silent, just still. You can, we have words like infinity and eternity conveying immeasurable states that, you know, that time or timelessness or distance that has no boundary, no end to it. And that we can't conceive, but we call it infinite, but it means that it's just beyond our ability to see any boundary, any limitation. And eternity as like time that goes on forever and never ceases. We think of it in terms of time rather than timelessness. And yet in terms of experience, eternity is timeless. And I think Blake had one poem about this eternity, you know, as the here and now, this sense of the eternal, the eternal moment, the presence now, the here and now is eternity. Where before I ever contemplated that word, I kept thinking of eternity as like time that just goes on and on and on and on and on, never ends. So this is where we contemplate, you know, we're considering now just with our language, with our concepts that we use, our thoughts, what do we really mean by these words? And what are they signifying? What are they pointing to? So in terms of direct experience in meditation, then Buddhist meditation, what do you do when you're meditating? Is your, you know, and the formal techniques of Buddhist meditation are around sitting still, usually, and concentrating the mind, opening the mind, being fully aware and awake in the present. So that this present, because this present moment is all we ever experience. That's all there ever is for us, is the eternal present. This is where the birth takes place, enlightenment and death is in the present. For us now, physical death, say, is in the future. But enlightenment is now. Enlightenment is now. I don't feel enlightened. Or Is it when you try to think of it and understand it through thought or analysis, you just get tangled up by it. You just go round and around, and there's no point in thinking or defining or trying to imagine it. But in the reality of it, the simple reality of that we consciously experience through awareness. So that's the gate to the deathless. And this gate is, you know, it's the entrance. And so it's like the human individual, each one of us is at this point, this gate, we're at this gate. There's death bound things are here. We're used to that. We're used to all this death stuff. All our stuff is about death. And so all this stuff, we're used to that. And this is the world, the sense of ourself, our personality, our cultural conditioning, our views and opinions, our emotional habits, our prejudices and biases, and our sense of self-importance, or self-hatred, and all the rest of it, the whole range of conditioned experience from A to Z is on this side of the gate. And we're here. We feel at ease within this side because we're used to it. So sometimes you find people just, you know, absorbing themselves in various obsessive ways of heightening experience, or through deadening experience, like the drug scene in the past 40 years in the West. And it's before, when I was a youngster, there were no drugs. When I was in the Navy, 1953-1957. And, you know, sailors, American sailors, aren't noted for just going to missions and playing canasta when they go to port. And so, so you find, you know, you're subject to quite a lot of temptations. And I was on a ship that was, you know, sailing all over the Pacific Ocean to Japan and Philippines, Hong Kong, and then west coast of the United States to Hawaii and San Francisco, San Diego, and wherever you go, there's always something that some kind of thing that they're trying to sell you. So in Japan, it was brothels. As soon as you got into the port, the taxi drivers were there, and they take you immediately to the brothels. In Hong Kong, it was the tailors. In San Diego, it was the Christian missionaries. In San Francisco, it was the homosexuals. So you had all this kind of these things, these specialties that each port provided to try out or to get to accept or refuse or whatever. But none of these ports ever tried to sell drugs. This was 1953 to 1957. A lot of liquor and drink and things like that, but no drugs. And this was so this is interesting. And then after the 60s, it was always this drug scene developed. Many young people now probably think of drugs as an ongoing problem. But say in the United States, I'm sure it was the same here in the UK. In the 50s, this wasn't a problem for most people, or rare, a rare individual would get caught into the drug scene, or if there was one. But now it's a very common problem, because this is also a way to influence conscious experience. Because when we think in a certain way, when we have a lot of negative imagery, negative thoughts and emotions, and that the drugs are a very quick way to just stop it all, isn't it? To change the mental quality of experience, either to dull it out or to heighten experience into making it kind of fantastic, or hallucinogenics, drugs make your mind very interesting, fantastic. Because the ordinary being, presence here and now, is overlooked all the time. We don't awaken to the present. Very few people really awaken unless they're in a situation that demands, like a dangerous physical danger, where you have to pay attention. When you're driving a car, isn't it? Something in you has to wake up to just know where you are and who's walking where and what cars are coming and where you are and read the signs. Or climbing mountains, glaciers, or rock climbing has become popular, where you train yourself to climb up rocky cliffs or escarpments, sheer kind of cliffs. Amazing thing what people can do just to be awake, to feel alive. Because when you're not awake, and your life has no intensity to it of any sort, one easily drifts into depression or despair. One gets bored, and one just cannot stand to be that way. So drink and drugs, doing exciting things, endless distractions, are ways of feeding the conditioned experience to bring the extremities of experience into consciousness. But that which is neither extreme, neither pleasant or painful, neither beautiful or ugly, neither exciting or boring, or good or bad, is something that sounds so dreary, so boring, so tedious, that we don't even contemplate that this is a possibility for us. Now, in the Buddhist path, the Buddha encouraged us to really reflect on the conditioned realm as experience. It's not to judge the conditioned realm. We're not going to say all the conditioned realm is just, you know, it's all impermanent and it's suffering, and just kind of dismiss life in general, the conditioned experiences and sensory experience and beauty. I've heard people say beauty is impermanent, you know, just dismiss beauty, don't bother with it, it's impermanent. Or love, relationships, just dismiss them as it's all suffering, all impermanent. And that's not reflecting, is it? That's taking a stand. That's using this Buddhist teaching to dismiss experience rather than to examine it. This is where sometimes the Vipassana teachings or the emphasis on meditation can be merely a kind of conditioning of the mind to just see things in a Buddhist, with Buddhist biases, Buddhist images. But when you really examine the Buddhist teaching, that's not what he was teaching. He didn't want that at all. It was just for us to just follow. Buddha said everything is impermanent and all beauty, and all these conditioned things are impermanent. They all are caused suffering. They're all unsatisfactory, and dismiss life. But the emphasis is on examination, on looking into. So this is where, in say Vipassana training, where you're looking into experience, you're actually observing what you are feeling, when it's not judging, it's not criticizing anything you're feeling, it's not praising or blaming or anything, it's just noticing. It's like this. That anger is like this, and greed is like this, and it's not saying greed is bad, is it? Greed feels like this. Feeling insecure and is like this. And so you kind of look inward, you feel confused or uncertain, insecure, and you you begin to look at it as it is, as experience, rather than just seeing it as some kind of personal stuff that you should be able to process and get rid of eventually. So you're really beginning to awaken the mind to the way things are in the present, to the many emotional habits we have already that we tend to just dismiss and ignore because they're maybe we don't like them, or we can't be bothered with it, or we just resist, or we're programmed to resist it or to deny them. So the awakened mind, waking up, listening, paying attention to the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the body. We all have a body, physical body now, so we start awakening to the experience of the body in the presence like this. And so you're looking at your body now in an intuitive way rather than in a vain way, where if you look in the mirror and say whether how old you are, whether you look good or not, that's vanity. But in terms of intuition, the body is like, you don't need a mirror. You can even close your eyes and you can still be aware of the body as experience, as feeling as experience, as mental. As the mood of your mind, the state of mind you're in, you can be aware of, is like this. So that these foundations for mindfulness, bringing into consciousness the way it is, and noting the changingness of it. Because when you really are with the condition of the present, you can't sustain it, you can't kind of petrify it into permanent. It's very, changeable. Like just awareness of the body. Try to petrify the physical body as experience in the present. It's impossible. I can't do it. Or feelings of any sort. Pain. Physical pain, which oftentimes seems, like a it's really permanent. But when you really open to this pain, physical pain, and observe it, it's very fluctuating, kind of rhythmic, and up and down, and fades out and intensifies, and it's movement, it's change, or mood, state of mind you're in. You can't hold it. You can't make it kind of fixated and hold it for very long, because it's just like it, once you really see it, it tends to, you're aware of its changingness. It's kind of the way it breaks up and doesn't have any core or anything that you can hold it together, except through ignorance, holding to the idea that I am angry. Or I am resentful, gives it a kind of solidity and kind of gives it a permanent appearance, which is not the way it really is, but the way we can believe in it, the way we tend to think about it. Contemplate this in your own life when you really pay attention to experience in the present. And that paying attention then is you can pay attention to boredom. Where this sounds boring usually, but paying attention to boredom isn't boring. We're not used to it. We're used to paying attention to things that are interesting, but things that are boring, we tend to get absorbed into the things that are interesting. We want interesting things. Pay attention to them, and then they absorb our attention. And then when they get boring, we tend to go on to something else. So boredom itself, or suffering, as the First Noble Truth, is to understand it, to really feel it, know it, examine it, investigate it. And then that you begin to see the recognize the presence, and then it ceases, it's absent. So this is why this gate to the deathless, this image of the point of intersection between the timeless with time, this point of, say, to me this means like each one of us is a conscious human being who is at this point of intersection. We're poised on this point where we can look at the death, and we can look at the deathless, realize the deathless. Now it's up to you to find out what that really is in terms of your own experience. Remember, experience is always now, so it's not tomorrow. It's now. By investigating the deathbound conditions, the conditioned realm, in terms of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not-self, what that really does, if done properly, is break down our attachment and our belief. It breaks through all our cultural biases and attitudes that have been influencing us all our lives. So as you begin to look at life in terms of these characteristics, these conditions as anicca dukkha anatta, and then what? Then you can also, when you let go of the conditioned realm and no longer grasp it or believe in it, then what is left is the unconditioned. You begin to turn to the unconditioned or the deathless. And that's called a realization. It's a reality that is now, but is generally overlooked, not noticed, because of our habits, which are very much formed with attachments to the deathbound condition. So this is the challenge the Buddha gives us. To wake up, and not just to sort out our stuff, but to recognize the way things really are. Whatever your stuff is, it's not yours, and it's impermanent, and it's naturally unsatisfactory. So it's not your fault. You know, don't feel bad because you're not perfect, or you haven't got it all together, and you're not. You know, maybe you've had many disappointments. Maybe much of your experience of life has been disappointing, despairing, or hardships, or maybe you've had to suffer unfair treatment and lack of recognition and love and appreciation. These are possible human experiences, but these are not obstructions to enlightenment. And this is the whatever karmic load you've had to bear, it's not a matter of it having to be a certain way, but whatever way it is, you investigate it in terms of instead of seeing it in a highly personal way, see it in terms of the way it is, or the Dhamma. All conditions are impermanent. And then you begin to, that awakened state, it's like it. You begin to trust it, and you recognize, realize the silence of the mind, the pure state of being. I remember we keep this Vinaya, this monastic discipline, very strictly. In the kind of monastery I lived in northeast Thailand, they very strict on this discipline, and they talk about purity in Vinaya. So I remember trying to keep all these rules as strictly as possible. Oftentimes it meant, you know, taking them to the most extreme interpretation, to make sure that your purity in Vinaya is sustainable. And so you can get really caught up into into this, into keeping all these rules, doing all these things right, in the right way, and then never feeling pure. You kept thinking, well, maybe there's something I'm not really facing yet. There's endless doubts coming into the mind. On the level of maybe, I've got to be more strict, or I've got to be, I'm not pure enough, and I've got to, why is it all these years I'm not pure, really pure enough? And then I began to recognize that that's not where purity is in keeping the rules. I began to contemplate, what is purity as experience? The Buddha said, the conditioned realm is not self. So if I think I'm pure or impure, that's a sense of self. Both holding to the sense of I'm pure or I'm impure. So then, just by recognizing that, the sense of purity is aligned with me as a person, or impurity, or purity, it's the same thing, the same problem. And then as your mind stops trying to become or create an idea of purity or becoming pure, you awaken to what is really pure, which is natural to each one of us. Purity is now. It's not something that you don't have. Even if you've been living the most disreputable life, you're still basically pure. And this purity cannot be made impure by anything you do or say or think. Do you believe me? So, contemplate this in terms of this purity. Then, but it's not personal. It's not like I'm pure as a person, because as a person, there's a lot of impurities. Personality is basically impure. It's imperfect. As nobody's personality is pure. No matter how good you are, you're still not pure. So then purity then is something else. It's not goodness, being good, but it's a natural state that we forget, that we separate ourselves from through ignorance. Even though we're not really separate, that forgetting it all the time, getting caught up, being fully bound into the conditions of being somebody, being a personality, being the body you have, or becoming whatever, or whatever views you have about yourself, good or bad, that whole kind of thought that those kind of thoughts and perceptions, if you just get caught into that, then it is an endless task. There's no way you can purify all that. Because those conditions are basically dukkha. They're all dukkha and they're all anatta. But this is, you're using these concepts to look at things, to reflect on them. So then the purity is realizing when through letting go of them. You realize the true nature of being is pure. And that it's and you remember it because it's like it's something it resonates in your heart. This is true. This isn't just me trying to convince myself of anything. It's like they say going home. It's your real home where you don't have to prove yourself. You don't have to become anything. You don't have to be anybody for anything for anybody. You don't have to. In worldly terms, the world suddenly is no longer what you're living for. You're no longer held and bound into those worldly attitudes. So you're liberated from the world. It doesn't mean you've rejected the world. The world no longer deludes, no longer is your refuge or the place that you're attached to. And so then you begin to appreciate your own humanity and the opportunity that we have as human beings for this realization and this liberation. Salvation, maybe. Because you talk to Christian monks who meditate, and it's not that, you know, they're doing the same thing, actually. And how they tend to have their own, you know, Christian terminology. But we're getting beyond the terms, isn't it? The terminologies aren't so important anymore because it's the experience, the reality of it. So I remember one time when Ajahn Chah was in England, the second time, and we were making this film called The Buddha Comes to Sussex for the BBC, and we went to this Anglican monastery somewhere in Sussex, or some kind of theological school or someplace anyway, Church of England. And the priest came out, and they were all kind of excited to have us there. And so one priest said, ask Ajahn Chah if there's a Buddhist ultimate truth and a Christian ultimate truth. So I asked Ajahn Chah, and he said, Ajahn Chah looks at me and he says, how can there be two ultimate truths? Ultimate truth is ultimate, you know, not two. No, this is what the aim is to realize that ultimate truth, you see, which is now, and which is so present that we don't notice, like a fish in the water, isn't it? Or, you know, so here, so much now, that purity is never separate, never lost, but we don't notice it. So we look for something else, you know, that's further away that we can, you know, we can see or conceive of. So this is where the emphasis on meditation is always the here and now, the awakened state here and now. And learning to really trust in that. It's something that each one of us has to trust in ourselves. It's not because, you know, you have to trust yourself to be awake. And it's not something that is difficult, but it's a matter of beginning to trust in it, but to really do it. And trust in the sense of just attentive awareness. Just a kind of listening state. It's not an absorbed state into a refined sense of tranquility. It's just this much. Silence, right now. The mind stops. The thinking mind, it's that much. And as you begin to realize that more and more, the emptiness of the mind, the silence of the mind, then it becomes clearer and clearer as a real refuge. Because that refuge is a refuge. It's something you can always trust in. It will always, you know, whatever's happening to you in life, it's something that you can always trust. It's a refuge that will carry you through difficult times, disappointments and loss and totally impossible situations if you trust it, and it's something that, like that you have to trust yourself to do. Nobody can make you do it. Not something that some teacher or enlightened master can get you to do. So it's not given to you by some. It's your the natural state of your true being. So it's a matter of remembering, reminding yourself, and trusting yourself to do it. So I offer this as a reflection, a gate to the deathless. The gates of deaths are open. Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara. This is the deathless realm, Amaravati. We've got two nice gates out there. Sometimes we close them, though. So don't depend on this, the deathless here. find it in yourself. There's only symbolic deathless. Then the second part, ye soda wanta bamunjan tu satang. Ye soda wanta. Soda wanta is one who listens, who's attentive right now. Those who hear, those who are hearing now, who are awake right now, trust in this, you know. Bamunjantu satang. Satang is faith. I have faith. And bamunjantu is kind of rest or relax into this faith. Give yourself to this and trust in this, in that pure state of just attentive awareness in the present. And no matter how many times you get carried away, you can always do it, start right now. It's not like you're ever really going to fail. If you start thinking of yourself as a success or a failure, don't believe it in terms of success or failure. It's not a worldly thing. So you lose it, get carried away, but then you remember. That point of remembering this is what you trust in. I notice it makes things very clear also in terms of experience, like the life we live, where you have to deal with maybe a lot of emotional stress, disappointing things and unpleasant things that happen to us, or unfair things, or things like, you know, really unwanted and unfair experiences. And I can see my mind, you know, goes, I've had enough of this. This is more than I can bear. And then I contemplate, and that is not the path, following that kind of thought. But this sense of trust and purity in the present. It's purity. Don't believe me, but when you begin to realize it more, it's very strong and very powerful and very natural. It's pure, it's intelligent. It's pure, intelligent. It's not a purity that's kind of a blank or dull. It's bright, it's pure, it's intelligent. So this is the why the human birth is regarded so highly in the Buddhist world. In the human birth is considered the best birth. If you're going to be born as a human. I used to question that a lot. I think, to me, for a lot of my life, I think it was a curse, being born as a human. I think being born as one of these kind of nice pedigree dogs that that upper class ladies hold on their lap. Take you for little nice walks on Hampstead Heath. Well, that might be a nice birth for a while, but pedigree dogs suffer a lot too. They get, you know, they go crazy sometimes. If they don't get their properly prepared shrimp at the right hour. So I offer this as a reflection for this afternoon. And there's tea, as you can see, over on the servery. And then in 20 minutes or so, I'll ring the bell, and those of you who wish to can come back to for further discussion.